Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Dr. Soren Show, discussing health topics that matter to you. The views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Soren and his guests and do not represent the views of Blue Sky Broadcasting. Consult your doctor before making any changes.
Welcome to the Dr. Soren Show. This is Dr. Soren Isparescu, and I'm really excited about our show today. We have Tricia Dickens joining us. Tricia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Dickens is a board certified emergency room doctor. She ran the Sandpoint Immediate Care here in Sandpoint, Idaho for about 10 years. And now you're doing locums work and you've been traveling all over. And most recently you've been doing a lot of COVID relief. And so as I talked to you, I was like, asked you if you would come on and just tell us a little bit about what you're seeing out there. Because, you know, I thank God that here in Sandpoint, we've been relatively spared from a lot of what we're seeing out there. And that's what kind of piqued my interest when I hear that you've been traveling. I said, what are you seeing out there? So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing, the different areas of the hospitals you've been at and kind of what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you're right. In Sandpoint, we have been really relatively spared. And I started traveling in probably May of this year, and I went to New York City initially. I kind of got there right as it was calming down, and I was in an overflow hospital that didn't have any critical care patients. They had all been stabilized. They just couldn't go home for a variety of reasons. And so I was there for about 5 weeks. And then I have been in and out of Texas since September of 2020. I started out in Laredo, where I walked into an ICU setting, and then also in El Paso doing ICU relief work. And now I was in Odessa, Texas in December, and I'm back there again in my lovely hotel room that I've been here for 2 weeks and will be here through the end of February.
Wow. Okay. So what are you seeing in how devastating is this, and what are you seeing in the areas?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because, you know, I see the sickest of the sick, right? I think that, so my vision gets a little bit skewed because 85%, the estimates are, of patients who get coronavirus are not going to be sick enough to require hospital care. In Odessa, the way that the system is set up is that we take care of all COVID patients on the CCU team. So we do the ones that aren't sick enough for ICU care but can't go home, so they need hospitalization. And also the ICU patients. So this particular hospital has it's the critical care team that takes care of these patients. They have one physician and one nurse practitioner. And so they typically do no more than 10 CCU beds. Mm-hmm. And only one of those beds is a negative pressure room that would be appropriate for a COVID patient. And they have a very robust OBGYN program at this hospital. So they had a NICU that they were able to convert into a COVID ICU. And there are 16 ICU beds capacity there. And also we have the capacity to take care of another 18 med-surg COVID patients. So in the time that I've been here, we've been at a maximum of 40 patients.
Wow.
Down to a minimum of about 26. Now that does include, you know, including the few CCU beds that are non-COVID that we also care for, but those are COVID patients. The ones that are in the ICU, so, you know, typically they have a maximum of 10 ICU patients. Now they have a maximum of 26 ICU patients. The vast majority of them are on ventilators.
Okay, so these are all ventilator patients. And so one of the things I know you told me initially is that when you got to these places, you were their relief. So they were like, you were their angel that just came in. Because you said these doctors have been working 24/7 trying to take care of these people.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can think, I mean, you've got one ICU pulmonologist and you have a nurse practitioner and they're trying to care for up to 30 patients, our average census is between 30 and 32. It's not possible. It is not possible.
How big of a city is Odessa? Sorry, I should.
I haven't even looked, to tell you honestly. I don't know. It's one of the bigger cities in Texas. It's kind of Odessa and Midland together. They're two separate communities, but.
Oh, yeah.
And there are two hospitals in Odessa.
Yeah, it looks like 119,000 is what Google says here. So.
But, you know, this is interesting, Soren, because it's kind of like a Sandpoint where we have a bigger catchment area. So Sandpoint may only be, 9,000 some population, but we have a catchment area of the whole county. Mm-hmm. We are receiving transfers from a lot of outlying facilities into the hospitals in Odessa and Midland.
Okay. So you guys are really two hospitals for this fairly large area.
Yeah.
And then on the ICU patients, what types of patients are you seeing? Are you seeing mostly old people? Are there young people? Are you seeing kids? Everything in between?
No, we don't do any pediatrics. Mm-hmm. So the youngest patient that we've had was a 27-year-old that was on a vent. He actually walked out of the hospital. He's the only one that I have seen walk out of the hospital. Yeah, wheelchair out of the hospital that was on a vent. I did, because I was curious when I was in El Paso, we had 40 vented patients there. Mm-hmm. And the average age was 62.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and do like the 27, do a lot of these have a lot of pre-existing conditions, or are you seeing the full spectrum?
He happened to be obese, but he didn't have any other medical conditions. There are people that might have prediabetes, they might have hypertension, but there are patients that are not on any long-term medication, couldn't say, but it's not schoolly people who are chronically ill, get sick, go on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's interesting. So you're seeing, you're kind of seeing the gamut of patients there. So it's not just old people or just one group. You're kind of seeing a variety of patients there. And then I got to ask these.
I would say that the median age, I would say, is somewhere between the late 50s to the early 70s. And then you've got the people on the either end of that. But most of the people probably fall in that category.
Yeah. Interesting. And then, but the only thing I was thinking though, is still in a town of 120,000 people to have 26 patients in the ICU isn't as bad as I initially had thought, but it's still terrible. So it's hitting people, but it's still a fairly large.
But remember, we're only one of the hospitals. There's another hospital that has higher capacity that is also past their capacity.
Oh, really?
So
these hospitals are at capacity.
Oh, well, I mean, we're 206% of capacity. Because normally we have 10 ICU beds, and now we have 20.
Yeah. Now, did you say the other city is Midland? Midland's bigger. It looks like 138,000 people.
Yeah, and I don't know how many hospitals are in Midland. We have two hospitals in Odessa.
Okay, so just Odessa has two hospitals.
Just Odessa has two hospitals.
Back. This is Dr. Soren. I'm talking to Dr. Tricia Dickens, a local of Sandpoint, who has been doing relief work as an emergency room doctor, ICU doctor in Texas. So Dr. Dickens, tell me about the types of patients you're seeing and what you're seeing in the ICUs over there.
But when I admit them, the people that get admitted fall within a time frame from the onset of their infection. So, you know, they got the coronavirus infection. Most people who get the coronavirus infection do fine. There's going to be a certain percentage, which I would estimate to be about 15%, just based on what, you know, research I've done on it, who are going to get the COVID disease and require hospitalization. And those patients are somewhere typically 9 to 12 days that we see them, and they are sick enough to either need high flow oxygen or a CPAP machine or a ventilator. So I've kind of created in my head, if you make it past this 10 to 12 day window and you're not in the hospital on high flow oxygen or a CPAP or a ventilator, you're going to do fine. If you end up there, what happens is, you know, we have patients that actually are 80 days into it. And they happen, the two that are like that right now that we have on service, we just got trachs put in them. And they're, you know, we don't know if they'll be vent dependent or not. Only time is going to tell. They still may not survive. This inflammatory process that gets set off from the COVID, you know, I tell people when I admit them, look, buckle in. This is not a, I came in 2 days, 3 days on my oxygen and I'm going home. You can plan on 2 weeks in the hospital. And they all look at, and that's a minimum. That's if all goes well. And they all look at me and go, you're nuts. I'm not going to be here for 2 weeks. And routinely they're there for 2 weeks. And we kind of tell them, you know, you're on this plateau. So you're on this plateau and you're stepping, taking two steps forward, two steps back, two steps forward, two steps back. And it changes from hour to hour. Like we'll walk through the unit and there'll be someone on a vent and you'll be like, oh my gosh, they're looking so much better. I mean, look at the numbers, and we follow the inflammatory markers. And then the next day you come through and you're like, what do you mean they're back on 100% oxygen? We just had them down to 45 yesterday, you know?
So and it's so, a lot of ups and downs.
Ups and down. It's a roller coaster. Buckle in. It is a roller coaster. And everybody, if they're a coherent when you come in, they're all like, what's my numbers? How am I doing? What do my numbers look like? And I tell them, it's not your numbers. It's how do you feel? How do you feel today? We want to see you take 2.5 steps forward today and maybe only 2 steps back tomorrow. And they reach this plateau. Once they get through that plateau, which, you know, I told you some of these patients are going 70, 80 days. Once they get past that plateau, if they're going to improve, they seem to improve pretty quickly. But they go home on oxygen.
Okay, so, that's what you're saying.
So what the long-term health consequences are going to be, don't know. Well, you know, we just took care of a 30-year-old woman who had a huge cerebellar stroke. And we couldn't figure out what the heck was wrong. She screened negative for coronavirus. So we ran a COVID antibodies and she was positive for COVID. So we believe there was no other explanation for her stroke. We believe that was the COVID disease that affected her blood system. You know, and I tell people, this isn't just a disease of your lungs. It's an inflammatory disease that affects every organ in your body. It's the heart, it's the kidneys, it's the gut, it's the brain, and the blood system. And who's going to get which portion of that, we have no way of predicting. And when you're in the midst of it, I don't know how you study it. you're just trying to bail water out of the boat to keep people alive.
Yeah. And so what are you doing for treatment and what are you finding is effective? Because obviously one of the things I've learned from this is you want to not be intubated. Like you really want to do everything you can to not end up. Because once you're intubated, it's not good.
It's very poor prognosis.
But my understanding, like, go ahead.
These people that are on CPAP for weeks, and we have patients that, and what we do is we'll use CPAP at night. And then if we can transition them to a high flow oxygen or a vapotherm during the daytime, we do so that they can eat, they can get out of bed, they can just get a break from the CPAP machine. We just intubated somebody yesterday who'd been on the CPAP for probably 10 to 12 days. And it was like, it's time. you're not moving anywhere and you are exhausted. I mean, you can just see it. They're just exhausted. Whether they will survive or not, I don't know. But there are no effective treatments. So we do corticosteroids, dexamethasone for patients that are requiring oxygen greater than 6 liters. Mm-hmm. If they don't, we don't do it. We do have remdesivir. There are some very strict inclusion and exclusion criteria for the remdesivir. Most of the time, by the time the patients get to us, they're past the point that remdesivir would potentially be effective anyway. They're already in the cytokine storm.
Early, maybe.
Maybe. I had a lengthy discussion with our pharmacist yesterday, and he, is saying that even the remdesivir, there's not a lot of data out there saying that it's going to be effective. So once you have the COVID, it really is a wait and see, and let your body just has to ride out the storm. If it's healthy enough to ride out the storm, you've got a good chance. If it's not healthy enough to ride out the storm, there's nothing we can do except support you while your body's trying to do what it can to heal.
Yeah. And one thing I want to just clarify, what you called COVID, you're actually calling the more severe disease that needs to be hospitalized, and you're calling the called a coronavirus if you just test positive, like you got the sniffles for a couple of days and then it goes away, because that's, for a lot of people, that's what this ends up being. But yeah. You're on COVID when they actually are sick in the hospital and need care.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that published anywhere, but that's how my brain kind of categorizes people. You got coronavirus, you got a little cold, you got better, or you got COVID.
Yes.
So and I just things aren't good.
I just want to clarify. So for 85% of people, like you said, they go anywhere from really mild symptoms of a little sniffles, lose your taste, are annoyed that you don't enjoy your food as much as you do, and that's the course of most people, to being like fairly sick for a couple of weeks and really low energy. I've seen a lot of people have those types of symptoms. It's low energy that really, and don't feel like eating. And those people get hit pretty hard. But again, most of those don't need hospitalization. But then you're seeing them at the stage beyond that, which is kind of sounds like this cytokine storm where it's almost like your body's fighting itself and your immune system gets really revved up. Correct?
It's horrid. Yeah, exactly. And one thing to point out too, again, I'm seeing the sickest of the sick. There mm-hmm. are plenty of patients that come into the emergency department who actually get discharged home from the emergency department on oxygen. They're patients that we would never, ever, ever have discharged in the past. So their oxygen saturations are 90% on up to 4 liters of oxygen.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. Can you imagine having discharged someone like that, Soren, when you were in medical school?
Yeah.
Heck no.
Right.
No way. But that's basically what we're down to. Like the other day, we had 0 COVID beds, 0. And they had a patient in the emergency department on 100% FiO2 on CPAP of 12 centimeters. And we're like, you're going to have to transfer them. We're getting calls in Odessa from Louisiana of providers looking for COVID beds.
Yeah.
The capacity in the healthcare system just doesn't exist. And keep in mind too, that all of the providers, the nursing staff, except for the nurses that are doing charge nursing, mm-hmm. are FEMA nurses. They're brought in from elsewhere.
Yeah.
They're not here in Odessa. Yeah. They're brought in from all over the country, Mississippi, New York, Vermont, California. Yeah.
Well, we got to take a break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Tricia Dickens.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that impressed me on your story, because what you were telling me is when you got there, everybody was just wiped out because these people are just working continuously nonstop trying to take care of these patients. And so you ended up being their relief. And it sounds like a lot of other nurses and healthcare workers have come in to try to help. And the hospitals have like increased their capacity by, it sounds like you're getting, you know, getting rid of the NICU and transferring that all into adult beds. So let's talk a little bit about, as we were talking about, kind of like, let's shift into this, the causes or what you can do, what you can't do. Let's talk a little bit about disinfectants. We talked about that. Where do you draw the line between being a psychotically, like continuously using, you know, wonderful hand sanitizer to, you know, I know you have some opinions on that.
Yeah, I think that as just as a general in our society, we tend to be germophobic. Mm-hmm. And we actually need these healthy bacteria that live on our skin and in our gut and in our respiratory tract to help fight off the bad players. And we talked about the example of C. difficile colitis. Many of us are colonized with C. difficile. And our good bacteria in our gut keep it under control. And when those get out of balance or sick, then the C. difficile has an opportunity to take hold and make you sick. So I'm not a big hand sanitizer. In fact, I don't hardly ever use hand sanitizer. I will wash my hands when I'm in the hospital between patients. But I don't see the necessity of hand sanitizing everything and wiping everything down religiously.
Because that's one thing that I think is very interesting. I think I got to be careful because I'm quoting from memory, but I think there was a study. The disease is multiple sclerosis or something like that. Oh. I think if I remember of a link to like hyper sanitizing, and you see some of these parents, you know, you kind of got both extremes, but. And I think neither is good. I think you just need to be reasonable. But some people just wipe everything down with antimicrobial Clorox, you know, alcohol stuff. But, you know.
And then they can't figure out why they can't get rid of MRSA. You know, it's like because you don't have anybody helping you.
Yeah.
If you shower three times a day and you strip off all the oils off your skin and you can't support a healthy microbiome and you're washing them all down the drain, then you're going to be more susceptible to opportunistic fungal infections on your skin and other bad players that can colonize your skin. It just makes you more susceptible.
And that's a very good point. So, like, bacteria is good. Some bacteria on your skin and in your gut, it's absolutely crucial. Like your gut
bacteria. This is Dr. Soren, and we've been talking to Dr. Trisha Dickens, a local Sandpoint physician who's been traveling to provide relief for COVID, learning a lot about what she's seeing, most recently out in Texas. And we were just talking a little bit about nutrition and soil nutrition because I'm very interested in not only how do we treat this if you need to go to the ICU, but how do you prevent this disease? How do you boost your own immune system? So we were talking about improving the soil nutrition and using organic methods. So go ahead and just take it from there.
I would not sanitize everything. Yeah, there are nutritional studies too that look at the nutritional value of the food.
I just think that's an important warning for people. Just remember your biome, and I love it that you're passionate because I've done this way before COVID.
Regenerative or sustainably.
You know, toxins
higher.
Like
now,
you
not
said,
organic,
there's more of them than there are of you.
Organic
you have
is healthy either
more cells
they may
in your
be using
gut bacteria that are not you that you're carrying around
fertilizer
than you
input
do of your body
as well.
So
and so
there's
even
a lot
the
of
difference
these things.
In the organic,
be nice to them, eat good food, feed them the food they like,
so
and they'll
really
be good to
you. Like
you
said,
versus
grow
you know,
your own,
bad
make
food,
your compost,
and then,
grow your
you
own
compound
food,
that with taking
and
antibiotics.
It will also be grown with love, which I think
you know,
energetics
of
food is important as well. But that's a whole other topic.
And some of those things that make you very, very sick. Well, I love what you're saying. So that's one of your, because
well,
the last part I want to do is kind of what to do.
Not only
so
it sounds
like one of the things you're recommending is
the development of autoimmune disorders because it disrupts the lining of the gut and allows you to develop immune responses to things that you would not normally.
Organically
the gut, people think of it. as, and, the gut is part of me. No, it's a conduit.
Yeah.
It's
again,
a, yeah, so, you know, of our gut is still external.
We don't have
to
any
us.
Effective therapies for COVID.
It's not
so we
part
do
of
use
our body.
It's a conduit
from our mouth
through
to blunt the immune system.
So,
but it. It's
yeah,
not necessarily
effective,
to right?
recognize
we're just
that
doing what we think we can, and we only use
body.
That with patients who are
we have to,
requiring
we have
six
to
liters
love
of
it
and
treat them
it, because
with respect
we know that they have
well.
Crossed this line into yep, cytokine storm.
Totally agree.
So
let's just
you know,
shift gear, kind of last little portion
there is no
I want to cover. So,
for COVID,
what are things,
the things that
you
can
do? So it's very interesting to hear this. And well, let me ask
you
another question related to that.
And that's not something that you can go.
What are some of the reasons you think we haven't been hit?
So I'm going to go run a mile
Sandpoint,
and
Idaho
eat some broccoli tonight
maybe
and
some of the other parts of the country that you've traveled to, like
of water,
New York,
and it's going
to
help
you know,
me be healthy.
LA
that's something that you had to be
like
doing
Texas,
leading up into
Texas
the
here,
exposure.
So. What are some of the reasons? And maybe? That's, I'm
yeah,
totally in
I think
agreement.
That,
like, it's like you don't
you know,
get try to get healthy
thoughts,
really fast. Hey,
even
better late than never, but
April,
the best plan
March,
is just
April
to
yeah, population density.
Exercise, get proper sleep.
And I still think that that is true
water,
to some extent.
Soda,
we live
right?
a very
hydrate
already
properly,
just by the nature of where we are socially distanced.
So.
Yeah,
by the way, just
for
one
the most part,
little, thing,
we're not packing into
hydroxychloroquine
restaurants
and
movie theaters
your thoughts
and
on those.
You know, play theaters and things like that. So we're already
I wouldn't take them.
Have that advantage,
okay.
But
there
I also
are
think
so.
That people,
and in fact,
I looked
Idaho
this up because I knew you were going to ask me about ivermectin because that has become the thing, and I will tell you that
of.
For the
use
two
of
weeks
pesticides
that I have been
and
here,
other toxins,
every
we're not
single patient that we have admitted to the COVID unit has been taking
in
ivermectin.
More dense areas.
So that is the new
and,
hydroxychloroquine.
Just eat food.
Because when I was in
yeah.
New York,
yeah, well,
every single
we
patient
about
had
that
taken
a little
hydroxychloroquine.
Bit, but you know, a lot of this
so
prepackaged.
So neither
and,
one of them have any proven
foods.
Benefits. You know, I've heard people say,
you know,
well, there's all these studies. So I just went
and
looked.
You know, I'm the vegetarian, so I always talk about that. But even people
over
here that aren't vegetarian. They're eating
I
like
could
you
not find them
you know,
if they
grass
exist.
Fed,
there
which
is
what cows are supposed to eat, right?
Trial study being done
you know,
right
they're
now.
They're not grains,
exactly.
They're actually
but
eating
it's not
grass
completed.
And hay and things
the
like that.
Studies
and so
that are out there
eating,
that
even if they
may
are,
show benefit
the meat they're eating is
like
a healthier meat, or they're eating a lot of game meat. There's a lot of hunters up here.
Studies where
so
you can't cohort
like
the patients
farms,
into,
you know,
you know, giving one of them placebo and one of them ivermectin.
You know,
so you know you have
places.
To compare it, and
yeah,
there's one
yeah.
other study that compares.
You know, and I would
ivermectin
take it a step
further to say,
with,
you know, in terms
hydroxychloroquine
of
and Zithromax,
just
there's no
production.
Placebo arm.
And we talked about a microbiome
so you don't know how
on our skin.
Well
there's a microbiome
would
in
the
dirt
done
as well.
A similar
and,
patient would have done
when
with
you start
no
putting all these pesticides.
And in my experience,
and just
it's
blanketing
just a matter
and trying
of
to
body
grow
monocultures
to
where you have to use the pesticides in order to maximize the yields on your crops.
And we have ways
it's unhealthy for the soil, which is unhealthy for the plant,
that,
and even the plant that you grow in that
but,
environment
you know,
is not going to be healthy for us
can,
to eat.
You know, through an IV
so
or through an NG
it's
tube,
all
we can put you on the ventilator
to
give you oxygen. And that's
very
about
interesting.
It.
I hadn't thought as much,
we do
but
routinely
you're
use blood
absolutely
these
right
patients,
about the microbiome
you know, they
and the ground.
I've
you're
seen
right.
amputations
because
yeah.
it talked
the
about when
attacks,
you grow using organic
vast majority
methods
of them,
and
once
you
go on the
dirt,
vent, if you're on
and
the
you're
vent
putting
for
all the nutrients
any period
in,
of time, you end up on dialysis too.
You know, you have much healthier
just because
soil.
Of the clotting issues associated.
We used to live out in the
and,
desert,
and these
they
are
didn't,
not like a pulmonary
and they,
embolus.
They would
you know, it's not an embolus
that
develops
and
breaks
a
loose.
House that was,
it's in situ
on that land. I remember they had a lot of bugs
in the
lot of
small vessels of whatever organism.
You know, that's like they're getting out in the desert. They're getting,
out, just
you know,
like the woman had
crops
the stroke.
A year. So they're just
you know,
throwing some,
a,
you know,
an in situ clot. It wasn't
few,
an embolus.
Nutrients, whatever, to get it to
so,
grow. Well, and then the next
I really
one. So
appreciated
really
your time
putting
and
in that
your
organic
expertise
way.
And
so
kind of hearing from
point.
The front lines.
I didn't think about that. And you're literally directly
yeah,
on
that's
the
another
front
one of my passions
there,
is soil health.
And it's a whole different
yeah.
picture there.
Well, I hadn't thought about that in this
and
the
so
plants.
I think the take home
so then when you eat obviously like organically grown
for sure
food where they actually are
real thing.
A lot of people
are dying.
You know, composting
areas,
especially if you do it yourself, you're putting all this love and good nutrition
you should have been
into the ground, not just like
stay
three
healthy.
Nutrients, which is I think
right,
what these mass farms
exercise,
do. And they buy liquid,
you know,
and then they
spray a bunch of
don't like
phosphate
populated areas,
chemicals,
wash your
kill
hands.
Everything else.
You know, a reasonable
and just add
amount
sodium,
of time.
Phosphate,
don't go crazy
and potassium, and you'll
hands.
Be fine, right?
Well, those are three they add, because I know they said there's three. They add like three chemicals.
I really appreciate you, giving me the opportunity to tell my story.
But again, when you buy this big, beautiful looking,
tomato, and then you get the ugly tomato from the farmer, from local farmer, it's not as bad as they said it was going to be.
The taste, there's no comparison.
I'm like, well, in North Idaho,
maybe not. We have to take a break right here, but we'll be back talking to Dr. Trisha Dickens and finishing up our interview.
Well, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to chat with us on that.
And avoid ending up in the ICU.
Again, thank you for joining us.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Dr. Soren Show, and we're on the third Monday of every month. I do try to archive most of these interviews on the YouTube channel, The Dr. Soren Show, so you may want to check it out there. Again, thank you for joining us, and see you next month. Bye-bye.